Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Senate Judiciary Committee last week referred the U.S. Supreme Court nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the full Senate, but first a promised FBI investigation into allegations of sexual assault by Kavanaugh must play out. The nominee has denied all the allegations, and many of his defenders say they would support him even if the allegations were true, because he was just a teenager at the time. So was his first accuser, Professor Christine Blasey Ford, who testified last week that because she was just 15, she was afraid to tell her parents about the alleged assault.
Brett's assault on me drastically altered my life. For a very long time, I was too afraid and ashamed to tell anyone these details. I did not want to tell my parents that I, at age 15, was in a house without any parents present, drinking beer with boys.
Coming up later, we're going to talk about the Boys Will Be Boys defense of Brett Kavanaugh and others like him who have been accused of such actions. Joining us now is Washington Post national correspondent Philip Bump, who has been covering part of the story. Welcome back, Philip.
Thank you very much.
The FBI is now allowed to investigate the third accuser. What's the significance of that?
Well, I mean, I think it obviously expands the extent of potential exposure for Judge Kavanaugh. I mean, we're not really clear that right now what new developments might emerge from that expansion. That third accuser, I think, is probably the least substantiated of the accusations that Kavanaugh faces, which I think means that there is more potential for the FBI to uncover something new.
Some have said that a week isn't going to be long enough to do this job. We have the Christine Blasey Ford allegations. We have the second allegation of someone Brett Kavanaugh exposing himself, and then the third allegation of gang rape.
Right. So, yeah. So, I mean, this is a 7-day period, a little less than that, I guess, really, given the fact that these things are sort of changing as we speak, which seems pretty obviously to be not very much time. I think that the FBI has already started its outreach. They've already spoken with some of these people. But obviously, this is not going to be the sort of robust examination of facts that you'd see in a normal criminal investigation, for example. But then it's not supposed to be a criminal investigation. It's just supposed to unearth whatever additional information they can. The FBI isn't going to then recommend anything in particular to the government. They're just going to provide details from the interviews that they had with various people of interest in these allegations. They're going to hand that over to the White House, and we'll see how much of that actually ends up becoming public.
Which was my next question. It's unclear how much, if any, of this will be public.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that it is certainly the case that this is something that has attracted an enormous amount of attention, and I think that the political fallout for the White House, should they choose to withhold any information, would be so stark that it would be pretty foolish of them not to simply release whatever information they possibly could. But then, you know, we've seen this White House keep its cards pretty close to its chest in the past, so it's hard to predict what they're going to do.
Republicans in the Senate have a slim majority. Obviously, they can confirm Kavanaugh, but they're waiting on this investigation because of Arizona Senator Jeff Flake's call for it last week. Did this call for an investigation, did the acquiescence for the request for the investigation, did it throw some other people off, perhaps? Is there any adjusted count out there?
No, yes. I mean, I think you're right that this is something that was an unexpected development. The Senate majority was hoping to have been able to have confirmed Kavanaugh already prior to the Supreme Court session, which began this week. I don't know that it's really shifted people's vote counting. Flake sort of, the Washington Post moved Flake from the going to support Kavanaugh into the might support Kavanaugh category, but it seems pretty likely he'll still support Kavanaugh. You know, we are basically at a place where there are four people who are sort of question marks about where they might land on this. Two of them, Senators Collins and Murkowski from Maine and Alaska, respectively, have both supported the idea of the FBI collecting more information. And so depending on what the FBI finds, their vote could go either way.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Washington Post national correspondent Philip Bump about what's up with the Kavanaugh investigation regarding his nomination to the United States Supreme Court as an associate justice. Philip, the president had a notable press conference last Thursday. People were pretty riveted to it. He said a lot of things. Is there any question about whether the Trump administration is micromanaging this investigation in any way?
Well, Trump is there have been a number of reports that suggest that Trump is really trying to push forward on this thing, that he has also sent word to Kavanaugh, either directly or indirectly, that Kavanaugh should push back hard on the allegations that have been made. And I think we saw some of that in Kavanaugh's appearance last week before the Senate Judiciary Committee. But that said, President Trump wants to fight this in a very President Trump-like way, which is to be brash, to be bold, to be unswerving, to be, to do it as quickly as possible, to sort of damn the torpedo strategy. He has been forced through the politics of the Senate to take it more slowly, I think, than he or Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell would like. And it'll be sort of fascinating to see what happens once the FBI completes this report. The odds, I think, are pretty good that they will say, there still is gray area. We still believe Kavanaugh, and let's go ahead and vote for confirmation.
But if there isn't, if something is uncovered, there are a lot of other people waiting in the wings, right? There's no shortage of replacements.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it seems pretty likely that should Kavanaugh withdraw or should his confirmation be defeated in the Senate, that the White House, I mean, they literally have an existing list of people from which they're drawing, which is unusual for a White House. There's some question. There was a report in Axios yesterday which suggested the White House would actually rather skip a confirmation fight, particularly if the Democrats retake the Senate in January. They would be happy to have a 4-4 Supreme Court that could be used as a political issue for the next 2 years leading up to the 2020 election. That was sort of a speculative report. It would be unusual for a White House to do, but this is an unusual White House, so we'll see.
At this point, what are the different factions, I guess both sides of the aisle, what are their calculations? I mean, what kind of missteps, or is it really up to this FBI investigation at this point?
Yeah, I mean, according to poll data that I've looked at, this is the most polarizing issue of President Trump's administration. It's more polarizing than the travel bans, more polarizing than family separations. There are really, really sharp partisan lines on this. And so to a large extent, there isn't a lot of wiggle room with senators. There aren't a lot of people who are saying, well, I could go either way on this. The Democrats oppose it. The Republicans support it. With two Republicans wavering and two Democrats wavering, both of whom are facing re-election in red states. So this really will come down to how much space this new FBI investigation gives those four people in the middle to either say, you know, we're going to stand with Kavanaugh and vote for his confirmation, or they uncovered something which I see as being prohibitive and vote against him. It really comes down to what that report says and how it's interpreted by those four people.
In the case of Joe Manchin, though, of West Virginia, Democrat from red state there, his concern about Brett Kavanaugh doesn't have necessarily anything to do with the allegations. It has to do with his statements made regarding health care for all.
Right. Well, I mean, yes, that's true. But Manchin is also, like any politician, particularly one who's up for re-election, has his finger to the wind to see what's going on in West Virginia. He's also said that he's very aware that West Virginians generally want to see Kavanaugh approved. If there is nothing prohibitive that comes out from that FBI report, you know, that he is wavering at this point in time, despite his concerns about health care for all, which I think it's important to note is a central part of his campaign plan. Mm-hmm. So he, you know, could be highlighting that simply to reinforce his campaign message. You know, depending on what the FBI comes back with, I think if those four people, my guess is they would probably vote together as a block and make that determination based on the political cover that's offered by FBI report.
This was already the quote unquote latest year of the woman when it comes to the midterm elections. Does this motivate? Does it suppress? Or does it just as much motivate people on the other side of that coin to get out and vote, do you think?
This is a central question, really. And Republicans have been arguing that the Kavanaugh nomination is important because if Kavanaugh's nomination is withdrawn, conservatives will be uninterested in coming out to vote in November because they'll be sort of disheartened by the process in Washington. The extent to which that's true is sort of hard to gauge, and the extent to which the Kavanaugh nomination is really energizing Democrats is also hard to gauge. But we do know that over the course of the past month in Quinnipiac University polling, we've seen a big surge among women in particular of opposition to Kavanaugh. And the Democrats, who normally fare more poorly in midterm elections like this because turnout is lower. We're already seeing huge signs that Democrats are really motivated to come out and vote, and I think that this could help bolster the Democratic vote, certainly. The Republicans already have the advantage of their voters usually go out and vote. And so, you know, the extent to which that's affected by Kavanaugh, I think, is sort of intuitively less than the effect that it might have on Democrats.
And one of the allegations that Brett Kavanaugh made during his last testimony was that this was a conspiracy, a left-wing conspiracy. Is there any evidence of that, or was this really, as Senator Dianne Feinstein of California explains it, just respecting somebody's privacy and delays on that behalf?
Yeah, I mean, there is not any real evidence of a conspiracy, barring the normal politics of this having emerged and people who don't like Kavanaugh's nomination seizing upon it as a way to try and derail that nomination, right? The Feinstein's explanation, I think, is pretty robust, which is that she was asked to keep this letter confidential, and she did so until it was leaked. It seems she denies that it came from her office, which, you know, one can be the judge of that, but it certainly seems as if she wanted to draw attention to the letter, she had other ways of doing it besides leaking it to the press. So it's sort of hard to evaluate that, and we'll look at that down the line. But there is not, I think, at this point in time, public evidence that there was any huge conspiracy to whip up phony allegations against Brett Kavanaugh, which now he is having to answer questions about.
And then just one last question, Philip. Sure. The lawyer that's representing Stormy Daniels, the adult film star, is also representing one of the accusers of Brett Kavanaugh. What is that? Donald Trump, the president, has made a big thing about that. What do we know about this guy?
Well, this is Michael Avenatti, who, if you've turned on CNN in the past 6 months, you are pretty familiar with him and have heard him speak, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, very adept at interacting with the media, which certainly served his client Stormy Daniels well in her interactions with the president. But I think that Avenatti is engaged in this. I'm not sure how his relationship with his client emerged, but it certainly is representative of the sharply political moment that this Kavanaugh nomination represents, that Avenatti would be involved simply because he is someone who is very attuned to the current political conversation. But I think that it also has meant that it has amped up the politicization of the nomination fight generally, because Avenatti is sort of persona non grata on the right because of his constant fights with the president. And so it's just all of this, the inherent partisanship of the moment, the fact that this nomination is the most polarizing issue, throw in Michael Avenatti, throw in Donald Trump, and this becomes a massive, massive fight that now comes down to this FBI report, and we have no idea what it's going to say.
Philip Bump, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Philip Bump, national correspondent for The Washington Post. Coming up, we're going to get to the boys will be boys assertion by defenders of Brett Kavanaugh, who say that some of whom say that even if these allegations that he attempted to rape Christine Blasey Ford back in the 80s when they were both in high school, even if he did attempt that, even if it was true, he was just a kid. Why would anyone hold something like that against him now? We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The sexual assault allegations leveled against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh have reopened questions about the weight of responsibility for acts committed as a teenager, especially when it comes to boys. Some defenders of Kavanaugh dismiss the allegations, true or not, as mere horseplay and reference the boys will be boys explanation. We want to talk about what boys will be boys means today. Psychologically, legally, culturally. Joining us is Ohio State Law Professor Martha Shamalis, who specializes in feminist legal theory and sexual harassment law. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Also by phone from the University of the South in Tennessee, psychology professor who focuses on the development of teenage boys, Sherry Hamby. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What do we know about where that whole reference of boys will be boys comes from, that whole attitude? Sherry?
Well, that's I think that comes from an older time when people didn't really understand some of the long-lasting harms of behaviors, like not just sexual offending, but also bullying and other types of behaviors that we used to minimize and not appreciate how long-standing the harms can be from those.
Like the boys may grow up and not be affected themselves, but their victims are.
I would say that it is harmful for perpetrators too, or at the very least, it often reflects, deeper underlying personality problems or sometimes substance abuse problems or other issues that carry well into adulthood, way past whatever the offending incident might have happened.
Meaning the memory of it, knowledge that you did do something like that can wear on somebody.
Well, there's definitely that. That's an emerging area of research, for example, with soldiers and veterans, and that some of their own offending can create PTSD-like syndrome. I meant the kinds of personality problems that the antisocial characteristics, the lack of empathy, the objectification of women that allow these kinds of incidents to occur in the first place, they just don't go away even if you only actually engage in offending a few times or over a short period of time.
How common is sexual assault among adolescent boys?
Well, the tricky thing about that is that it's important to realize that it is an epidemic in the sense of it just is a massive, massive public health burden that takes away from the quality of life of so many people. But at the same time, it's just like any other epidemic. It's like flu or something like that. When we have a flu epidemic, it doesn't mean every single solitary person has the flu. Most of the estimates are somewhere in the, maybe 10 to 15% range of adolescent boys. So the takeaway from that is it's a huge public health problem. It's far too many men are engaged in this kind of behavior. Also, just important to realize that it's not a normal or inevitable part of male adolescence at all.
Right. That was my next question. Is it inevitable? Do all boys, if they so feel the impulse, have to follow through on it? And what about the human development at that stage in boys? What do we know about the different parts of their brain and how it works?
Sure. Well, there's a reason that it's a high risk period, not just for sexual offending, but for all types of criminal behavior. And, as Dr. Blasey Ford actually spoke very eloquently of some of what we know about the neuroscience. But with boys, their frontal and girls, too, their frontal lobes are not fully developed, which help govern impulse control. They are still, exploring. They have a certain feeling of invincibility, which is good in some ways because it kind of helps them get out into the world and out of the nest, if you will. But those are the types of things that can put them at higher risk for all kinds of problematic behaviors, not just violent behavior, but also it's why it's the peak risk period for substance abuse, for suicidality, for all kinds of things. But nonetheless, most adolescents sail through, that time period and into young adulthood without ever coming anywhere close to committing these kinds of offenses.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're delving a little into the idea of boys will be boys. That's the defense that some people have given for the alleged assaults by Brett Kavanaugh, the nominee for the United States Supreme Court. You just heard from Sherry Hamby. She's a psychology professor from University of the South in Tennessee. Also with us, Martha Shimalis. She's an Ohio State law professor. She specializes in feminist legal theory and sexual harassment law. Martha Shimalis, so how much does the cultural acceptance of boys will be boys, all things being equal, how does that play into what happens legally when allegations like these are made?
Well, certainly the notion that boys will be boys isn't codified
right
in any law. So on the books, the idea of sexual abuse is generally gender neutral, and both boys and girls have to refrain from imposing their sexual desires on someone else against their consent. But as an informal matter, these kinds of cultural views very much affect a lot of different areas of law. So with respect to sexual assault, I will say that the way I think of what might be part of the content of Boys Will Be Boys is that boys want and need sex, and girls have a responsibility to stop it. That very old view that it is somehow the women's responsibility to prevent rape. And so this is, of course, we know a flashpoint in terms of just under what circumstances should we consider a sexual assault to be rape or attempted rape. I have to say that with respect to the allegation by Dr. Ford, I think there's no question now that that fell into the attempted rape category or assault category if we believe that her account is accurate. She said no, clearly. She said she screamed. He continued despite her her saying no. And there didn't seem to be any other situations that we could consider to be ambiguous.
Sherry Hamby, I read that even children as young as 2 or 3 understand that a scream is a signal of something bad.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't have to be 25 years old with a fully developed prefrontal cortex to know that that's a sign of something amiss.
Absolutely. And I think that that's a perfect illustration of what's wrong with this boys will be boys argument. You know, even very young children understand the idea of consent. They understand the idea of distress. I mean, it's just preposterous that under the circumstances that were described by Dr. Blasey Ford, that, you know, it's if you have to put your hand over someone's mouth to stop them from screaming, then it's just not ambiguous at all about whether or not that person wants to be there. And I think that's one of the problems with this boys will be boys developmental argument. I mean, I'm the mother of 2 teenagers, and the idea that they don't understand issues around consent and issues around distress is really just preposterous. Of course they know, and the people who commit those kinds of behaviors understand that what they're doing is wrong and violating somebody else. And that's where these personality issues about lack of empathy or callousness or objectification come in, because really it just takes a special person to look at someone and think, oh, I bet I could overpower her. And then, you know, even to actually go ahead and do that, that's just not typical adolescent behavior.
Let's turn to some callers now. Daniel and Gahanna, you're on the air. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Respectfully, I have to disagree with your assertion that many of Kavanaugh's defenders would support him even if the allegations were true. That strikes me as a straw man argument. Since the allegations surfaced, I haven't heard any prominent Republicans or even individuals that I've talked to make such a defense.
I have heard many people on I've listened to them on the radio and I've watched them on television. They're maybe not prominent Republicans, but there are plenty of people out there I have heard say that. That's why I asked the question. But point taken. I mean, that's a debatable, arguable assertion. So
sure.
Go ahead, Daniel. I want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I would just say, as the father of a teen girl and an American who treasures American values, I would join you in disgust at that such a non-defense. Boys and girls in high school should not be given a pass for sexual assault. That behavior should never be normalized. And I couldn't support any political leader or any candidate or judge who would be proven to have engaged in those behaviors. But likewise, I think guilt until proven innocence mm-hmm. can't be normalized either. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the presumption of innocence is really what's under attack here, and that's the view that of most Republicans that I know.
Well, what we're really, Daniel, but what we really want to talk about today is that attitude of boys will be boys. I mean, certainly you have heard that reference in the last couple of weeks since these allegations emerged of people saying, "Well, my gosh, that happened over 30 years ago. Why would you hold him responsible for something that happened when he was a boy?" You've heard that,
yeah. I would say the only time that I've heard that, and I try to take in a broad range of media, the only person that I've heard make such an assertion was Matt Iglesias on his Twitter account. And he's, a fairly prominent liberal journalist. In the conservative circles, nobody I know is saying something like that. And I think they would be roundly excoriated if they did. You know, everybody really understands that this is a horrible, at least allegation, without respect to whether it's true or not. Right. If it proves to be true, I would certainly not support that person being in any office.
Okay. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you for your time.
You bet. Okay, so it seems like Daniel and I are listening to different things. And I respectfully note that he's not hearing the same thing. And you know, that brings up another issue, Sherry Hamby, is it feels like people are hearing very different things and seeing being informed by very different things, everything from Brett Kavanaugh's testimony to Christine Blasey Ford's testimony. It's very personal.
I do think that, that definitely there's people are going to hear different things depending on what sorts of media they listen to. But I think that Daniel has raised a couple of important points. One about this issue of whether or not that you were talking with him about, whether it matters so many years later. And I think that really depends on how Judge Kavanaugh himself, if these allegations were true, handled it. And I think that what you can see, the reason that so many people are saying it still matters 30-some years later, is that if this is this unresolved dark secret in his past, then you would expect him to behave just in the way that he has done by, telling what seem, to be very difficult to believe statements about other aspects of his adolescence, to be showing to be portraying himself as the victim. There's a saying in victim advocacy world, it's called DARVO, and it stands for deny, attack, and reverse victim and offender. And that was just a textbook case of trying to portray himself as the victim and talking about the last 2 weeks of his life. Well, Dr. Blasey Ford has lived with this experience for over 30 years. But certainly some people who have histories of perpetration can move beyond those. And I have, in my experience, seen a few people truly and genuinely do that. But it always starts with the truth. And when you can't even substantiate a number of the claims that he was making about and numerous different incidents and behaviors during adolescence.
Are you still the Sherry Hamby? Okay, it looks like we lost Sherry Hamby, so we will work on that for the moment. Martha Shimalis, what Sherry Hamby just mentioned about that Brett Kavanaugh's response to the allegations is sort of a textbook denial. It's a classic defense of somebody when they're on the stand.
Well, and this is true, I think, with people accused of all kinds of misconduct. Often we don't have the kind of coming clean, at least initially. People tend not only to deny particular events, but even aspects of events. And so often what you have in the courtroom, I've seen it just in reading briefs on both sides of a case, is the experience that many people felt when they watched the hearings. They watched the hearings and they said, "I think Dr. Ford is telling the truth." And then at least some other people watched Judge Kavanaugh and said, "Well, I think he's telling the truth, too." And this is not uncommon. And partly memory can trick us, but also there can be dissembling about whole or in part of one's experience. I found, was just mentioned, the kind of mercurial demeanor that Judge Kavanaugh had to be very disturbing. He was enraged. He was also tearful. He was combative, but then at times he seemed to be mournful even. And I just think that that range of emotions, to me, doesn't tell us much about who's telling the truth. And a lot of experts say it's very hard for people to know who's telling the truth. The one thing that I will say is, and this goes to Daniel's point, this confirmation hearing is to determine whether a particular nominee is fit to sit on the highest court. And it requires us to feel that we have the senators that are voting on this must feel with confidence that this is someone who is qualified, has the judicial temperament, and has the kind of high ethical standards warranted to sit on the court. And when there's doubt, in this case, I would think it would serve to give one pause and not to vote to confirm. So in that sense, it is very different from a criminal trial. And in fact, it's very different from a civil trial, where usually the plaintiff or the person who's making the charge has the burden of proof. You know, the Democrats have called this a job interview. I'm not sure I like that, although I think it's accurate to some degree. Instead, it really is a fitness determination.
Carissa in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Carissa.
Hi. All right. So I'm going to try to keep this as on topic as I can and let this be a therapy. Okay, so I know in my experience, it's really hard to tell the difference with intent of like what was an accident versus what's inappropriate versus what constitutes as a criminal action. And basically, like the situation I found myself in was that when I was 12 years old, my 18-year-old cousin was visiting in from out of town, and we were upstairs watching cartoons together in our house. It was nighttime, and he was stroking up and down my thigh. And I froze in place, and that, like, was a trauma response for me. And it took about 45 minutes for me to be jolted out of it when I felt his fingertips start slipping up my shorts. Mm-hmm. And, like, at that age, the choice to me really seems like, do I give the benefit of the doubt to him and kind of keep the peace, or do I unleash like a lot of pain within my family by bringing this up when I wasn't even sure if there was any criminal recourse or if it was inappropriate? Or I even thoughts in my head were like, does it make a difference if it was my outer thigh, my upper thigh, my inner thigh, my lower thigh? Like, and I think it took me almost 10 years. It took me until the day after the 2016 election to tell my dad, and he was the first and still the only family member I've talked with him about it. And I want to give him lots of props and give him a shout out because he's been really validating and really has taken this in stride. And like, so that's been helpful. But I think at the end of the day, like if we're assuming boys will be boys, then kind of we're implicitly assuming like a naive intent. But that, like, then the girls and the women that this happens to are almost like their scapegoat rather than a victim or someone who experiences hurt and confusion. And yeah, that's what I have to say about it.
Well, Carissa, thank you. I mean, you've raised a really interesting nuance to this question and that idea of naivete or not knowing what they're doing. Thank you for bringing that up. And I'm sorry for your pain. And thank you for sharing it with us because these all are little pieces to a puzzle. Sherry Hamby, what about that sense of, gee, I just didn't even really know what I was doing. I didn't mean to do that. Is that plausible?
Well, I also want to thank Clarissa for sharing your story. And I think it helps so much to, you know, to bring this back to what kinds of behaviors we are really talking about. And no, I don't think that that's plausible at all, that an 18-year-old boy of or young man, really, of, you know, of average or above intelligence would not understand that that's not something that you're supposed to do. And it is absolutely illegal to for an 18-year-old male to touch a 12-year-old girl like that. And you know, I just think that that's a perfect illustration of how harmful it is and what a violation it is. It's just so important for people to realize that. And I think that that is one of the reasons why Dr. Blasey Ford's story has had such an impact, is that I think that not only are there, you know, so many, you know, millions and millions of women and also, you know, men too, and people who have, you know, other gender identities who have been through this experience, but that there is almost probably nobody in the country who has not been touched by having a loved one go through this in some way. And that is why I think it's been such a powerful cultural moment. And I just really admire your bravery, Clarissa, and everybody's bravery who is coming forward to help, bring some of the depth of what's happening here forward for everyone else to understand.
Clarissa, thanks again. Take care. Okay.
Oh, wait, could I add a really quick note?
Sure.
Looking back on the incident, I have zero evidence I could bring forward. Like, it was just two people in the at night on a futon. So it's like guilty or innocent until proven guilty is like, I have nothing to prove guilt. So, yeah, that's I'll leave it with that.
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Clarissa.
Absolutely. And I would just add, I'm not sure where she was calling from, but the state laws vary quite a bit, if assuming that she's over 18 now, about whether or not this would be something to bring forward, or how many years it was. It's been reported in Maryland, sexual assault of a minor, there's not a statute of limitations, but that would be another issue depending on what state you lived in.
Clarissa, thanks again. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to add another voice to our conversation about what we teach and our children in Ohio. Not a lot when it comes to these issues. Almost nothing, as a matter of fact. So stay with us. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the boys will be boys culture in the U.S. and whether what you do as a teenager should matter when you're an adult. Still with us is OSU law professor specializing in feminist legal theory and sexual harassment law, Martha Chmalas. Also with us by phone, psychology professor from the University of South in Tennessee, Sherry Hamby. And joining us by phone as well, executive director of Advocates for Youth. That's a nonprofit that promotes sex education, Deborah Hauser. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the education piece of this. Where does one learn about the issue of consent? And where does one learn about what's the difference between patting somebody on the knee and stroking their legs, as was described in our last heartfelt call?
Yeah, it's a really great question. In the ideal world, we'd be learning it everywhere, right? So you'd get it from your parents, you'd get it in your home, in your faith institution, and certainly you should be getting it in school. But the reality is that very few schools and very few states are really doing a comprehensive job around sex education that also includes consent education, what is healthy and unhealthy relationship looks like, and even helping young people to develop the communication skills to communicate their boundaries and also their desires, and to understand the concepts of bodily autonomy and mutual respect.
You know, when I was in the fifth grade, we had sex education in Michigan, and I still look back on that and realize I didn't even know what they were talking about because it was strictly anatomical. It had nothing. I still, you know, was like, looked at those pictures and thought, I don't understand, where is this thing called a uterus? But be that as it may, there was literally no reference to the cultural implications of sex.
Sure. Yeah. I think in our country, I think people are so afraid of having these conversations about sex and sexuality with young people. This myth that if you talk with young people about sex and sexuality, that it makes them have sex. And that's no more true than umbrellas causing rain, right? What we know from 30 years of public health research is that young people who actually get sex education early and often, and that it goes beyond what you just described as like the plumbing to things that are more about the social and emotional implications of growing up, of sexuality, of sexual development, of having sex, that those young people are much more likely to be able to make healthy and responsible decisions about sex as they do grow up.
And Sherry Hamby, does that play out in your work as a psychology professor studying adolescent boys? If they're more informed, do they make better decisions?
Absolutely. I would definitely agree with everything she said about what we should be doing in terms of sex education. And also just, you know, at this age, kids are really keen to understand how to have healthy relationships. They're keen to understand their bodies. They're keen to understand sexuality. And, you know, there's a real opportunity there to take a much more positive and proactive approach to show them what, you know, healthy sexuality is and what, you know, a healthy adult identities are. And unfortunately, too much of our sex education or our prevention is just all focused on red flags and warning signs and right. things that they shouldn't be doing instead of helping them understand what kinds of things they can do and how much of a positive aspect of their adult lives that can be.
Yeah, if I may,
sure.
I would totally agree with that. So much in so many school districts, sex education is either perceived to be or actually is controversial. And so as adults, we kind of run away from it sometimes and abrogate our responsibility, leaving young people to fend for themselves, either to get the information from each other or the internet or someplace where it might not be as we would like it to be. Instead, if we could sort of, you know, grow up and have these conversations, really talk to young people about all of the social and emotional things that are going on for them, they would be much more open to talk to us as well. And that is also incredibly important. But instead, we take sexuality and we put it in this like tower and we say it's forbidden fruit. And we all know that when you're young, the thing that your parent or your educator says don't do, that's what you go to do. Instead of that, to normalize sexual development and really talk about healthy relationships and how you interact, healthy sexuality, what does that look like? What does it mean? What are the values behind that? It would totally change the way that young people interact with each other and with us.
Yeah, Martha Shmalis?
Yes, national policy, insofar as we have a sex education policy, has been largely centered on preventing pregnancy. Again, the women's responsibility, the problem is with the women, without saying that teen pregnancy isn't a problem. We definitely now know that we need sex education to prevent sexual abuse. And where that's happening, or at least has started to happen on a rather large scale, of course, is in colleges and universities. Particularly during the last administration. So I do think that when I talk to my students, even in law school, sometimes they never have had a kind of opportunity in an educational setting to talk about important concepts like affirmative consent, about rather than touching one's thigh, one should stop and ask. It's not that difficult sometimes to be able to concretize some of these concepts like consent, like abuse. And I think part of the boys will be boys culture is this idea that we can't break what some sociologists have started to talk about as toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. Now, it's hard to think about toxic masculinity when you're thinking about young boys, but that's where that culture starts. And I have to say that a lot of the media about Judge Kavanaugh has concerned these cultures in which boys act to impress other boys. Mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of what was talked about in the Senate Judiciary Committee was going drinking, lifting weights, the kind of masculine culture. And often what gets folded into that is a kind of looking at girls and women as the others, as the other, as someone to conquest. And that does produce the higher levels of sexual assault in many frat fraternities, other types of organizations where men are impressing other men.
Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Right in the line with your most recent guest who was talking on the idea of education in schools and behaviors, most people didn't know coming into this that Ms. Blasey Smith and Judge Kavanaugh came from very exclusive, wealthy, upper-class prep school background. And the little bit that I could get coming through in the hearings revealed a somewhat shallow, pretentious, hedonistic, exploitative, sort of toxic environment. She just used that word toxic, too. I was thinking that. And I sort of wondered if that background in it, even of in itself almost, might be a disqualifier. But I think the thing maybe more important is she mentioned in education in schools that it tended to be strictly anatomical or just prevent pregnancy. And a lot of religious traditions, your body is regarded as the temple, not in a puritanical way, but in other words, it's something you give it great care and you care for others. And it has to do not only with sexuality, but eating disorders, alcohol, drug abuse, and things. And wondered about what she mentioned, the concept of positive role models rather than just saying these are the forbidden fruits and you can't do them. And okay. I'll take it off here.
All righty, Mark. Deborah Hauser?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Mark. You know, I was interested in listening as we talked about colleges and, you know, some more education about consent. It really starts at the beginning. It starts when young people are very young. And I do believe that if we were able to have sex education in elementary school, it isn't that you're talking about sex, but that you're laying down the foundational work. So when you teach a young person, you don't steal another child's toy. You have to ask for it. That's the beginning of consent education. When the other child says, no, you can't have my toy, you have to respect that answer and turn away. That's also part of consent education. Okay. The fact that the other young person has the right to say no is about really understanding bodily autonomy. So there are many, many lessons that we could be giving very early that really don't touch on sex, but are laying the foundation for what healthy relationships look like. Why is someone your friend? What do you get from that friendship? What do you like about that friend? That's the same thing you're going to be talking about later when you're talking about what are you looking for in a partner. So I do think it's important to have sex education early and that it goes way beyond what we're doing now, although there are some places that are really trying to do a very good job. Most places are still struggling. And to Mark's question about role modeling, I think it's incredibly essential to have good role models. Your first sexuality educators are your parents or your family of origin, and the way that they interact with each other and the way that they interact with you really starts teaching you about relationships right from day one.
Deborah Hauser, Executive Director of Advocates for Youth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Totally a pleasure. Thank you.
And Sherry Hamby, Psychology Professor at the University of South in Tennessee, thanks to you as well. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, well, thank you.
And Martha Shimalis, Ohio State Law Professor, specializing in feminist legal theory, sexual harassment law. I'm glad you could join us today. Thank you, sir, for your time.
Thanks so much, Ann.
Thanks to everybody else. Thanks for those calls. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.